Hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm Dean Welty, along with Rita Dunaway, and this is part two of our series on the Supreme Court, the U.S. Constitution, the nomination of a new Supreme Court justice, and why all of this matters so much today. We talked last week about two very important cases that the Supreme Court decided recently in defense of freedom of speech and religious expression. Those two cases that we talked about involved a baker named Jack Phillips in Colorado. The second one was about pregnancy centers in California. In both cases, the defendants were being forced to act and to speak in ways that violated their religious beliefs. There are many more cases just like that. A florist in Washington, bakers in Oregon, photographers, circuit court clerks, one in Kentucky. But in our third program, which will air next week, we'll be talking specifically about the nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court and why that, too, is so important. But let's get back to today's topic. We're going back to the root of all this, and that is our U.S. Constitution. And now is a great time. It is a perfect time to do it, because on Monday, we will be celebrating the anniversary of the signing of the Constitution at Independence Hall in Philadelphia on September 17, 1787. And we're going to be talking in this program, why was it so necessary to have this Constitution? What does it actually say? How is it structured? Why does it matter? Anyway, 231 years later, so what? Well, Rita, we have come a long way since then, and I know you have some serious concerns about where we are today. Could you start us off with just a little background on why it was so necessary to have this Constitution that we still have before us today?
Well, first of all, Dean, I think it's important for everyone to understand that it wasn't developed just out of thin air. Rather, it began with the earliest settlers in Jamestown in 1607 and on to the Pilgrims and Puritans several years later. Even before they landed at Plymouth Rock, the Pilgrims even developed their own mini-constitution called the Mayflower Compact. All of the colonies operated under British charters originally, but they too created their own constitutions that spelled out their purposes and also how they were going to govern themselves, even though they were still under British rule. So it came naturally to our founding fathers to do the same thing, but on a national scale rather than simply as colonial governments.
In fact, Rita, just to that point, they drew language from many of the colonial charters and constitutions. So just to reinforce it, this didn't come out of Thomas Jefferson's fertile imagination. He drew from long precedent. We like to use the word precedent.
Yeah.
And so this has a long history. But you know, Rita, it's really interesting to look back at how all of that developed. The colonies had gotten used to having their freedom as self-governing communities. This freedom is really the theme that we're talking about. But when the British abused their power and intruded on those freedoms, and they have a list of 27 of them or so in the Declaration of Independence, this long trail of trials and usurpations, they were eventually forced, that is, the colonial settlers, they were eventually forced to declare their independence and to fight for their freedom on the battlefield. And so that really is what triggered the Constitution and brings us back now to the discussion of the Constitution, because it was in that Declaration of Independence of 1776 that the major themes of the Constitution were introduced and developed. Now, let me name just a couple of those major themes. The Declaration of Independence talked about the laws of nature and of nature's God. It talked about the inalienable rights that we receive not from government, but endowed to us by God Himself. And it talked about the important role of government in securing these rights. Rita, I would just like to add something here. It just came to me this morning as we were thinking about that. Our founders were almost unanimously devout Christians. They knew their Bibles.
Yes.
And that Bible had a tremendous impact on the formation of America, on the drafting of the Declaration of Independence, and on the Constitution itself. We cannot overestimate the influence of the Bible on this. William Blackstone, one of the legal jurists in Britain from whom many of our founders drew as their source, said this: if any laws are contrary to Scripture, they have no validity. And the founders are very conscious of having their laws consistent with Scripture. And it will surprise many of us, it did me, that there was a study done by professors in Texas about the sources that the founders used for much of their drafting and the content of the Declaration and the Constitution. What were their primary sources? The Bible was 34% of all their sources.
Wow.
More than four times more often than any of the other three highest sources that drew from Montesquieu, from Blackstone, and from Locke.
That's incredible.
Let there be no doubt that our founders were influenced by their Christian beliefs. So, Rita, it's clear that the government's power also came only from the consent of the governed. This
right.
is a key
yeah.
statement in the Declaration of Independence. It didn't come from government. It came from the consent of the governed. So, it also says, if the government abuses its power, as King George had done, it too could be abolished and replaced by we the people. So, Rita, when our founding fathers were faced with forming a new government and drafting a constitution, how did they incorporate those themes from the Declaration of Independence into the Constitution?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me first note, Dean, we are sort of purposefully doing it. We're skipping over the Articles of Confederation, right?
Yes.
And heading straight to the Constitution because that's what is important today. That's what we live under today.
Although I think it may be worth noting, Rita, that the Articles of Confederation were determined to be too weak. They needed
right.
a stronger
exactly.
instrument. Exactly. Yeah.
But when it comes to the Constitution, I really think the first three words of the preamble say it all. And those, of course, are we the people. The Constitution then goes on to list the major purposes of this new government: to establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty for themselves and their posterity.
There's that word liberty again, isn't
right.
it? Freedom.
Right. And that really, as you were pointing out, ties it back to the Declaration of Independence. As you know, the Declaration was sort of the animating spirit behind the Constitution. And I think that two of the most important features of the Constitution are contained in the Bill of Rights, which were later added as amendments to the Constitution. The First Amendment, of course, which provides guarantees that our freedoms will be protected in several specific areas, including freedom of speech and religious exercise, as well as an assurance that government will not force a national religion on the people. That's the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. Then we have to look at the 10th Amendment, which places very clear limits on the power of the federal government, stating that any powers not specifically granted to the government by the Constitution remain with the states or the people. That is why we call ourselves a federal or constitutional republic, because the Constitution affirmatively lists the powers that the federal government has. If it's not in there, the federal government doesn't have it.
Rita.
And that was the point of the 10th Amendment, to really emphasize that.
Rita, that really brings back the purpose of this program, because several years ago when they were debating health care,
yeah.
Somebody asked Nancy Pelosi if there is authority for them to do this in the Constitution. Her response was, "Are you kidding?"
Yes.
Are you kidding?
Isn't that just, you know, I laugh because it's so
pathetic.
It's so pathetic as to be comical, but it really is a serious development that we've gotten that far away from the Constitution. So, Dean, tell us a little bit about the structure
yes.
that the Constitution sets up to achieve these goals.
Well, the structure really reinforces the purposes that you have just described. But I think we have to go back to the Declaration of Independence and how that is so closely linked with the Constitution. I really like the analogy of looking at the Declaration of Independence as providing the engine for this new nation. But the Constitution then created the frame or the body for this new engine. Others have referred to these two polars as two anchors that are designed to keep the nation from drifting off into dangerous waters. And I think we're going to get into a little bit of that, the dangerous waters that we're facing today. So against this background, I would say that the Founding Fathers faced two major challenges in creating this new Constitution. And remember, we talked about the Articles of Confederation as being too weak.
Yeah.
So the Founders' first challenge was how to avoid giving government too much power, overreacting, so that it might become tyrannical. However, their second challenge was to avoid giving government too little power, as with the Articles of Confederation, so that it would not be able to achieve its purposes. And that, of course, was the situation that they were facing. Both extremes they had to avoid. Well, along with these two challenges, Rita, continuing on the structure, they also had to prevent any one person or group of persons from accumulating too much power for themselves.
Yeah, and I just want to comment on what you just said, because it really goes back to the point of the Founding Fathers, by and large, being devout men who knew their Bible, and it was because they knew, both from biblical text and from actual experience, that all people are, by their very nature, sinful and selfish and tend to be out to get more and more power. And so that was their whole motivation for understanding, for knowing and desiring to limit the power of the government.
Rita, they knew their Bibles.
Yeah, they did.
And you have just referred to Jeremiah 17:9, which talks about the depravity of man. The human heart is deceitful and desperately wicked. Who could know that? So because they were so aware of this, they devised a unique system of checks and balances. And along with that, they put in place a clear separation of powers between the three branches of government. That is, the legislative, the most important in their minds because they write the laws, the executive as second because they are supposed to enforce the laws, and then the judiciary, which was the third in importance. They were simply to examine the law and interpret it according to the Constitution.
Yeah, and I would add there's another separation of powers inherent in the Constitution, and that's the division of power between the national or federal government with limited specific powers and the states that had much broader authority.
An important note, that is the 10th Amendment that we talked about, which says that the national government has no more power than that which is specifically delegated to it by the Constitution. The states and the people have all the rest.
That's right.
Well, Rita, we've covered a lot of ground already, but we have a lot more to go. One thing breaks through in all of this detail. The Constitution is so easily ignored or trampled on today, but we owe our founders a deep debt of gratitude for the work they did. The Constitution stands out as one of the most remarkable documents in human history. It has served us well for these 231 years. And as Ronald Reagan said and cited at the beginning, it is our responsibility to defend it and to protect it for our posterity to do the same. Okay, well, now that is our challenge, to defend the great Constitution from those who would try to ignore it and push it aside. So why? Why would they want to do that? So that they can transform America into their own distorted and destructive version of utopia. How do you see it?
Well, I'm going to get a little bit personal here, Dean.
Let's do it.
I took my first course in constitutional law as an undergraduate political science student. And I'm going to start there because throughout that semester, I wondered constantly what it was I was missing that must be essential to understanding the Constitution because I did well in the class, but I simply could not grasp the connection between the text I read in the Constitution on the one hand and our actual federal government on the other hand. How could a government granted so few powers in the Constitution wield such incredible authority over every aspect of its citizens' lives? It's hard to think of an area of life that the federal government does not have its hands in and regulate in some way. How could that be?
Well, I'm interested in the answer.
So my puzzlement, Dean, persisted through law school, where the overwhelming majority of my studies were dedicated to reading and dissecting judges' interpretations of the Constitution and other laws, not necessarily to reading and understanding the primary sources. And it wasn't just my law school that does it that way.
I can understand your confusion.
Yeah.
How on earth could the government have accrued such power to itself? But this approach really does follow the modern judicial trend of basing landmark constitutional decisions not on the Constitution's text itself and its meaning when it was written, we call it original intent, but instead their view of constitutional meaning as expressed in recent court cases, really goes back to precedent, or we call it stare decisis. And Rita, that sounds a little confusing. Why not? I mean, precedents are important. But I got this picture. I didn't think of it myself, but it made it so clear to me. I think of a home builder who's building, putting together the rafters of a house. He cuts a pattern. He uses that first rafter to cut his second rafter. But Rita, you must be familiar with building. You just built a new building not too long ago. What do you use to cut that third rafter? Would you use the second rafter or the first rafter?
I'd want my builder to use the first one.
It's the original one.
Yeah.
That's the only one you can depend on. And if you continue to depend only on the previous rafter, you're going to come out at the end with rafters that don't fit the bill, don't suit their purpose.
That's right.
Well, there's another.
Okay.
For our younger listeners, maybe they still play the game of telephone that we used to play. You start a story. You tell it to the person beside you, and it goes down to 15 more people to pass on. By the time it gets to the 15th person, that story is nowhere close to the original story.
Yeah, I think that's a really good analogy, Dean, both of them. What has happened is these modern interpretations of the Constitution have stretched the meaning of the text to the point of absurdity, to the point, in fact, where no average American or poor little law student could possibly tell you, even after a careful reading of the Constitution, what it will be deemed to actually permit or forbid, because the interpretations have gone wild. So the functional application of the Constitution has been divorced from its text. And, you know, a good example of this is the whole explosion of the rights of privacy. It's mentioned nowhere in our written Constitution, but rights of privacy were allegedly discovered there by the Supreme Court in the 60s and said at that time to preclude states from regulating contraceptives. Today, they have evolved to dictate whether and how states can prohibit abortion, among other things. And that's just one example of the trend. Other examples would include the bizarre way that the Commerce Clause is interpreted today to give Congress power over almost anything and everything that has the slightest effect on commerce, or the way the General Welfare Clause in Article 1 is now interpreted to give Congress the power to tax and spend for whatever it thinks is helpful. In short, our nation has become unmoored from its textual anchor, like you talked about anchors in the beginning. Now, we know that some citizens are happy with all of this because they're happy with what they get as a result of it. The question for the rest of us is, are we willing to entrust the future of our society to the particular whims of whatever person or parties manage to rise to power?
Well, Rita, I laugh.
you were talking about the economy and the Commerce Clause, and it reminded me of something Ronald Reagan said in 1961. The government's view of the economy could be summed up in a few short phrases. If it moves, tax it. If it keeps moving, regulate it. And if it stops moving, subsidize it.
That's good.
And that is the way, that's the way that this happens. It's a creeping vice on our freedoms. And that's what I think we're talking about, the attacks on our freedoms.
Yeah, it's not the rule of law. The way I sometimes describe it to people, it's as if the Supreme Court, every time it upholds some power grab, is making an informal amendment to the Constitution. It's not a written amendment. It's not a legal amendment because it didn't follow the proper protocols. But it does effectively change how the Constitution will be interpreted the next time.
Because the precedent has become constitutional law.
Yes.
Yep. Well, Rita, so how do we fix it?
Article 5, Dean. How do you like that first
reading,
sir?
I think I've heard that before.
Since the dysfunction of our government is the result of the perversion of constitutional text, the logical solution, the legal and constitutional solution, is to overturn those perversions, those precedents, through explicit constitutional amendments that clarify the true meaning of the language that has been distorted, like the Commerce Clause, like the General Welfare Clause. Imagine Congress being limited in clear, modern language to using its taxing and spending power solely for performing specifically listed duties under Article 1 of the Constitution. Imagine how much of the crazy bureaucracy that would eliminate. Imagine a Congress whose commerce power is specifically limited, as it was meant to be, to regulating the interstate transfer of goods. What we would have is a leaner, more efficient federal government, a drastically reduced federal bureaucracy, and a return of most policymaking to the state and local governments, which are far more accountable to the people. What we would have, in short, Dean, is the restoration of federalism and the rule of law rather than the rule of a few justices.
Well, that sounds perfect, Rita. I mean, I don't have much hope that Congress will propose this kind of constitutional amendment because it limits their power. In fact, it reminds me of what one of our Virginia legislators said, there's no such thing as a self-butchering hog, and they're not going to do it to themselves. So if they're not going to do it, Rita, what is this Article 5 all about and how do we do it?
Well, first of all, before I forget, I want to encourage listeners to visit conventionofstates.com to learn more. There's all kinds of information there. But in a nutshell, the other way to propose constitutional amendments is that Article 5 allows the states to propose amendments if 34 states agree that they should meet to consider amendments on a certain topic. This allows the states, Dean, to go around the federal government to achieve constitutional amendments that check and balance the federal government, including the court. That's what's most important here. So if 34 state legislatures pass resolutions applying for a convention to propose amendments on a certain topic, like limiting federal power, then Congress has to set a date and time for the initial meeting.
34 states.
34 states.
How's that going? I know you're working on it.
We've got 12 so far. We're on our way.
Is it possible that state legislatures, some of the state legislatures, really don't want to curtail power? They're
like
the Congress.
Oh, yes. I don't look for California or Rhode Island to pass this resolution anytime soon. So we need the other states to act.
If you get that, what happens then?
State legislatures select the individuals who will make up the delegation that represents them at the convention or the meeting. The state legislature can send as many people as they want, but each state only gets one vote at the convention. And once the delegations go to the convention, they hash out wording for specific amendment proposals that accomplish the objectives stated in the 34 state resolutions. In the case of Convention of States Project, my organization, those have to be proposals that impose fiscal restraints, limit the power and jurisdiction of the federal government, and set term limits for federal officials.
Rita, I know we're very concerned about the court, but when you say limit the power and jurisdiction of the federal government, does that include the courts?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because that's difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if we can do it, why aren't we doing it now?
We need to do it. Yeah, this is the tool we need to use.
So all the convention then can do is propose amendments, right? It can't actually adopt them.
That's right, and such an important point. Any proposals that are supported by a majority of the states at the convention and within the scope of the topic set by the applications get sent back to the states for ratification. And only amendments that are ratified by 3/4 of the states, that's 38 states, become part of the Constitution.
That is a nice prescription, but it's going to be very difficult to get it filled, won't it?
That's right. The difficulty isn't something that's ever stopped Americans before, Dean.
Well, Rita, what are some of the real weaknesses that you see in the government today? You mentioned fiscal irresponsibility. You mentioned abuse of power. Does that sort of cover it?
I think overwhelmingly just a violation of the rule of law. We have allowed these informal amendments to our Constitution, largely at the hands of the court, and we no longer live under the rule of law. If you can't read the text of the Constitution and know what the federal government is allowed to do and not allowed to do, that's not the rule of law.
Okay, can I mention one other possibility in the interim until you reach this magic number of 34?
Absolutely.
Which is to elect godly legislators to government responsibility and office. And secondly, to install judges to the Supreme Court, the federal courts, who will be faithful to the Constitution as written and not according to their own particular ideological bent. Can we be doing those two things?
We absolutely can and must do those things, but that will not in and of itself correct the abuses that have been done to our Constitution because it doesn't reverse precedents. So we need to use the Article 5 tool the founders gave us.
Well, it raises the question of settled law. Maybe there is a possibility that constitutionally minded judges can revisit old decisions like Roe v. Wade or like Obergefell v. Hodges, talking about abortion and same-sex marriage. So maybe that's not entirely out of the realm of possibility.
If we had 200 or 300 more years to wait, would be possible.
You know, Rita, in our conversation, I take hope, though, that there is a fresh breeze of freedom blowing in the land and that we might have some hope in who will become our new Supreme Court justice. Well, on that point, we're over time. Rita, you mentioned earlier we need to check the power of the court. We are out of time, but we'll be talking about that next week when we discuss the nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. Thank you so much for joining us. If you would like to listen to the program again, share it with your friends, go to our website, valleyfamilyforum.org. I want to thank our sponsors at Blue Ridge Chimney Services and the dental practice of Scott Dunaway, and to many of you, your prayers, your encouragement, your financial support. If you would like to make a tax-deductible donation to help keep Crossroads on the air, you can do so by check to Crossroads at P.O. Box 881, Harrisonburg, 22803. I'm Dean Welty with Rita Dunaway and engineer Robbie Meadows, inviting you to join us again next week at the Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. And until then, have a great week putting your faith into action.
Rejoice, rejoice, rejoice.